What is up, my nasty New Year's necromancers? On this bonus episode of the Warped Reality Podcast, John Wright will be talking about Dr. Alvin Lawson. We'll talk about a heroic flying creature, the most haunted house in Australia, and much, much more. So pop that bottle and let's break some New Year's resolutions.
Do aliens exist and are they among us? Are weird creatures lurking in the darkness? Do evil entities hide in the shadows of your bedroom while you sleep? Join us as we explore all this and more on the Warped Reality Podcast.
What is up, everyone? Thank you for joining me on this bonus episode of the Warped Reality Podcast. I am your host, Ghost Joe. So on these episodes, these bonus episodes, I like to throw some different things in the show that may not be completely paranormal related in essence, but would most likely still appeal to the majority of this audience. This is the case with Edgegrave Dave's segment in Horrible Reviews this week, where he speaks about the late wrestler Bray Wyatt that had recently passed away in the fall. I am so sorry, Edgegrave, that this took so long for me to put out. You know, my schedule has been insane and I'm just getting around to it now. You know, I love you, my friend. And yeah, so check it out. Here's Edgegrave Dave with Horrible Reviews.
Horrible Reviews with Edgegrave Dave.
Greetings, grave diggers. Edgegrave Dave is here. And on a very somber note, I would like to review, discuss, and acknowledge a wrestler by the name of Wyndham Lawrence Rotunda, otherwise known as WWE's Bray Wyatt, who has just died and passed away. At the time of this recording, I actually just returned from Florida. Even I like to get some sun every now and again, take the family. I just visited my mother-in-law who had moved down to Claremont, Florida, outside of Orlando. And this is actually where Bray Wyatt has just died and passed away. How ironic that life can be. As I leave Claremont, he left us. Not since The Undertaker has there been such an innovator and creative genius as Bray Wyatt has provided us. I also do want to mention that this also came at the same time as another wrestler, Terry Funk. And if you don't know who he is, check him out. He's had some of the most gruesome matches in history, and another person that comes back from the golden age of wrestling. You know, horror comes in many different shapes, sizes, and media. And, you know, even in this PG era that the WWE has, you know, there really wasn't somebody quite like Bray Wyatt. You know, his father was actually a wrestler named IRS that I wasn't actually sure if he was him until I actually looked it up. But Mike Rotunda was his father. He also had the grandfather of another famous wrestler, Black Jack Mulligan. And I'll never forget when Bray Wyatt first came out, he was part of this really scary, almost Texas Chainsaw Massacre-like family called the Wyatt family. He came out with this lantern and this kind of like Louisiana Southern type, really scary character from the swamp. He carried this lantern. You know, he always called all of his fans fireflies, and everybody would come out. And, you know, he was a villain at first. And, you know, he had this other, you know, scary two other characters with him. And, you know, one of them, I also do want to say that we're still feeling Luke Harper, you know, who had also passed away, and there was Eric Rowan. We had these three scary men with beards, and for a while, Braun Strowman was part of that too, but not to digress here. He brought such a horror type of element to him, some of the craziest matches that you've ever seen, the way that he infiltrated matches, the way that he struck fear. He fought people like Randy Orton, John Cena, when the Shield was around, when you had Roman Reigns, Dean Ambrose, and Seth Rollins. You know, things just imploded, and he just really gave so much. And at the last Raw anniversary, The Undertaker, it looked like there was even a passing of the torch to this character. The way that he would terrorize wrestlers, there were early comparisons to Charles Manson. The character did draw comparisons to Robert De Niro's portrayal of the character Max Caddy from the 1991 film Cape Fear. Later on, when he returned, he actually had this brilliant idea, which was like a Mr. Rogers type of horror show called the Firefly Funhouse. Man, this was creepy. You had these puppets. You had this buzzard type character. You had this scary type of Vince McMahon. You know, he had this sort of split personality where he was Bray Wyatt, but in a more Mr. Rogers kind of a way, not so much that really kind of sneaky swamp Texas Chainsaw Massacre character with the long beard and the hat and the Hawaiian shirt. Now he came in this kind of children's type sweater, kind of nice guy, but sinister type character. And then when he wrestled, his split personality was the Fiend, which is this grotesque clown where the lights would turn off. And he actually had a mask that was commissioned by Tom Savini. Yes, the very Tom Savini that was responsible for creating Jason and the Friday the 13th franchise and Dawn of the Dead and so many other things. And, you know, Tom Savini, as I have mentioned in other podcasts and reviews, has just given so much to, you know, horror and to the community. I was overjoyed that he was part of that. As being the leader of the Wyatt family and as being this villainous sort of cult, he really did strike fear and really make people think. He was a very psychological wrestler, even though that he was a very big man. He took part in some excellent feuds, storylines, and also eventually even corrupting Alexa Bliss, who really sort of started out as almost this like Barbie style cheerleader, eventually being this almost like Harley Quinn character with all these sort of horror type aspects, really fully turned into this kind of gothic character with this doll. And the creativity that Bray Wyatt had to help to make other people relevant was just unparalleled. It was unbelievable. You know, he was just somebody that also gave back very much. I heard stories about how kind that he was and just about how he let new people in, and he just did so much for the industry. In many ways, you know, he was like our Undertaker in a sense after the Undertaker retired. And the whole passing of the torch on that, you know, last sort of legacy Raw that they had, it was just unbelievable. It was a great ceremony. You know, just if you do have a subscription to Peacock, which is where the WWE Network now lies, or if you just go onto YouTube, just, you know, look him up. He's the Eater of Worlds. His entrance, you know, the way that he came out in the rocking chair, the way that people just gravitated towards him, he was just really something to see. And he was also one of the first wrestlers to have cinematic matches too, you know, where there was this Wyatt family compound. And I remember also that he had this crazy cinematic match where John Cena was in that Firefly Funhouse. And it's just, you know, when he came on, you know, it's, I mean, in the PG era, you know, there's kids watching this. There's it just really sort of, you know, stopped everything where you have to look and say, what is he going to do next? So in the spirit of just, you know, sharing our condolences, I just do want to thank Wyndham Bray Wyatt for everything that he's done for the industry, for helping make new people fans, for, you know, really, you know, showing that horror is a way of entertainment. And in a way, it's also a gateway to many movies too. You know, you might watch this and say, you know, where does he draw his influences from? What can I check out? What can I see? And that's just it. You know, the wrestling community, and as I've mentioned in previous podcasts, the horror community is some of the warmest, most genuine people that you can find. And even having a conversation with somebody, you know, about some of your favorite things that you've seen, you know, it's just a great kind of a brotherhood and a community. Oddly enough, I did check out a place called Hulk Hogan's Beach Shop. There is a spot in Orlando as well as in Clearwater. And it's just so odd because I go there and like this little kid, I was taking pictures in the ring that he had, which was half Hulkamania and half NWO when he was the evil Hollywood Hogan. And it just sort of pumped me up in this wrestling mood. And then, I get a text from, my brother, the Confessions of an Angry Metalhead, Mike Alexander, that Terry Funk passed away. And then I find out that Bray Wyatt passed away. You know, it just really sort of makes you think of your own mortality. So I know that we're kind of getting dark here and even darker than usual, but I just want everybody out there, just, you know, celebrate, just, you know, take all these icons and all these people that entertain you, appreciate them, and just, you know, use it to just kind of relax, to unwind, and just, you know, make sure that you have fun the way that you want to have fun and do what you want to do. Because though it's a short ride, you know, life could be also a really fun ride. So, all right, enough of this ride over here. Next time we're going to go back to our regularly scheduled horrible reviews, but, you know, why don't you go on Peacock and check out an awesome match, and hopefully it'll leave you in a really good place. And that's a great way to celebrate. So I rate this guy 5 out of 5 graves for what he's done for the wrestling community and just for the entertainment that he's provided us. So thank you very much, Bray Wyatt. Wyndham Rotunda, we got a grave for you, my friend. All right, take care. Edge Grave out.
Hey, thanks a lot, Dave, for that awesome segment. Yeah, you know, for me, I was never really into the wrestling community. I never really got into it as a kid, as an adult. It was never really a big thing for me. But I do understand the loyalty and how big and how great the community, the wrestling community is, and how important it is to everybody as well. You know, it goes the same as far as the paranormal community, the podcasting community, the horror community, and even, you know, another thing that I'm very subscribed to is the hard rock and heavy metal community is also very, very loyal. And, you know, everybody's kind of like a huge, huge family, you know, and it's just, it's really fun. Everybody gets together and talks about, you know, their experiences with everything. So I am very, very happy to feature this segment on the show today. It really seemed like it meant a lot to you. And again, I am extremely sorry that it took me so long to put it out, you know, but I'm glad to do it anytime. And yeah, man. So, you know, rest in peace to Bray Wyatt, and, you know, my condolences to his family and all of his fans. So a woman was driving with her 2 children in central Ecuador when her van started careening out of control and was headed towards a very large cliff, when out of nowhere, giant wings appeared, enveloping the van and stopping it from going over. The woman was totally confused and wasn't really sure what or who it was that saved them. Was it a Thunderbird? Was it an angel? Who the hell knows? Of course, she's grateful for this happening, but she's a little concerned that this creature may return. Her kids, oddly, don't remember anything, though. This was an account that I had read from a message on the FeedSpot message boards. So now, let's get into our right headspace with our buddy John Wright and his segment about UFO expert Dr. Alvin Lawson. Take it away, John.
Thank you, Joe. Glad to be back. This new segment is dedicated to Dr. Alvin Lawson. I entitled this one, Thank God for Skeptics and Unsung Heroes. In regards to education, Dr. Lawson was able to achieve a bachelor's degree in English from Berkeley in 1952, a master's degree in English from Stanford in 1958, a PhD in English from Stanford in 1967. As far as credentials are concerned, he taught at Cal State Long Beach from 1962 through the mid-1990s. One of the things that I thought was really interesting was he actually taught a UFO literature course. What he believed was that this topic pushed the students to use their creative and descriptive writing to explain the phenomenon. In the 1970s, he was also credited with starting what they refer to as the UFO Reporting Center of Orange County, California. Now, I know you heard me go through his education background, and none of the things that showed up was neuropsychologist or anything about psychiatry or anything along those lines. So why am I talking about this guy in regards to hypnotic regression? In full disclosure, I'd never heard of Dr. Lawson prior to becoming a UFO investigator. Nor had I heard of the experiments that he had conducted. I was familiar with the usual suspects, you know, like Dr. Simon, Sprinkle, McDonald, Hopkins, etc. It wasn't until I read Curtis Peoples' Watch the Skies that I was introduced to this, I'm going to call him believer, who maintained an objective and somewhat skeptical approach to the UFO puzzle. I truly believe that Dr. Lawson does not get the accolades or the acknowledgments that he rightly deserves. And again, I come back to, no, he wasn't a neuropsychologist, but what he was an intelligent person. And yes, he had an interest in UFOs, but he never, ever let that kind of ruin his objectivity. And that's the reason why I think this guy is such an interesting character, especially when you take into account during this time frame, it's you have all these different sort of quote unquote experts who blindly believed any and all claims of people claiming to be abducted. I refer to him as a voice of reason. And in, I'm going to call it a dark time. Why? Because he dared to ask the question, what if these stories are just a product of being hypnotized? In my mind, it's what if these stories are just stories? So he was able to get into contact with another gentleman that he worked with, Dr. William McCall, and they'd brought up the hypothesis of what if we do a controlled experiment to test the idea that maybe these stories are a product of being hypnotized, or maybe it's just something that comes from somebody's creative mind. So he, along with Dr. Herrera, who they note as a technical writer, and Dr. McCall began their experiment. So how does it all get started? So the screening process is where all this kind of comes together. They send out an advertisement in the local university newspaper. And what they were looking to do was see if they could find people to fit like three criteria. They were looking for people who had never seen a UFO. They were looking for people who were not interested in UFOs. And they were looking for people who did not claim or were ever thought to have experienced any sort of abductions. In the actual advertisement in the newspaper, they'd asked for people who were quote unquote creative verbal types. And they wound up receiving a number of responses, and they went through an interview process to kind of filter out those who did not fit the above criteria. And so it begins. They were able to pare this down to roughly about eight people for the experiment. Now, as far as the experiment was concerned, Dr. McCall is the one who would conduct the hypnosis. And from what it says, he would put them into a deep trance-like hypnotic state. He would then tell the subject that they had been taken aboard a flying saucer and given a physical exam. The subject was asked to describe his or her experience. They noted that each session lasted approximately about 1 hour. Now, both Dr. Lawson and Dr. Herrera prior to the start of the experiment had talked about what they thought would come out of this. And they believed that Dr. McCall was going to have to do a lot of prompting and coaxing and things along that nature to try and get some of the responses that we'll call them real abductees had reported experiencing. Much to their surprise, Dr. McCall said that it really didn't take a whole lot to get the desired desired results. As far as prompts are concerned, he basically, when he would put them under, he would let them talk and let them talk freely. And he said the most frequent prompts were, can you describe the interior, meaning the craft? And then from there, maybe every once in a while, what's happening now? Just to have them clarify what it was that they were experiencing at the time. When you compare this to some of the other things that we've seen or heard, and I'm going to use Bud Hopkins, because again, I'm sorry, I can't stand it. It just drives me nuts. You have other guys like McDonald and Sprinkle and so on. When you look at what it was that they did compared to what McCall did is very minor in the scheme of things compared to what these other ufologists did. What I also thought was courageous on the part of Dr. McCall and on the part of Dr. Lawson is they would actually ask UFO investigators to come in and be a part of this process. And I'll come back to that a little bit later on. As far as the results of the experiment are concerned, Dr. Lawson had compared the results of his real his abductees or imaginary abductees to those of the real abduction stories. Now, this included a lot of the stories you've probably heard of. One of the more widely known ones being the Hill abduction. What he noted was that there were no substantive differences between the real and the imagined accounts. He concluded that this study had provided evidence showing that imaginary abduction subjects under hypnosis report UFO experiences which seem identical to those of real witnesses, i.e. abductees. Dr. Lawson used the information from the study to write a paper. That paper was titled, What We Can Learn from the Hypnosis of Imaginary Abductees. The paper would appear in the November 1977 edition of the MUFON UFO Journal. What I would tell you to do is if you go online, take a look, you might be able to find it. The way that I was able to find it was through a website called weakandweird.com. It was on their website. They had done a couple different articles. They did a part one and a part two. You were able to read through part one, and then you were able to click on it, and it would take you to, part two. So going through that, it gives you somewhat of a summary of the paper. Now, what I thought was this was kind of an enlightening article. The findings I thought were most interesting from the article deal with a few different categories. So I'll try to categorize. I'll try to be as specific as I can, try to give as much info as I can. And Joe, I'm doing my best to try and keep this to about 15 minutes. You'll have to forgive me if I go over by a minute or so. One of the things that really popped out to me was they did these with couples, meaning like a husband and a wife or a boyfriend and girlfriend. They also did this with twins. And one of the things that they called it was multiple witness abductions. And one of the things that had come out of this was they had noticed one witness would kind of dominate the conversation, that one witness was, we'll say, more positive about the abduction. They were more articulate and they were more cooperative with investigators. Dr. Lawson provided several real examples that were identical to the imaginary abductee cases, and he said the most notable among them was Betty and Barney Hill. One of the things that they had noted with the whole single person dominating, there were times where the man or whoever it was, the opposite of whoever it was that was dominating the conversation, would usually ask to be woken up because there really wasn't anything that they could add to the conversation. And once that person had been brought out of that trance-like state, the person who was still under would then take bits and pieces of information that were stated by the partner, and they would start kind of weaving those things together to make a story. And if we take a look at the Betty and Barney Hill thing, if you take a look at the very early reports that come out of that, the very early tapes, and you'll find that Betty and Barney had completely and totally different stories. But then as time goes by, their stories start to become one. And one of the things that Dr. Simon noted when he was treating them was that Betty tended to be the more dominant of the two. The second thing that came out of this that I thought was really fascinating was what they refer to as verbal phenomena associated with hypnotic regression. So this one dealt with witnesses who were recounting what was said to them by their alien abductors. And in this process, they would experience some different things. One of the things that they would experience is stuttering. So the one particular case that they talk about, there was a gentleman who was asked what was being said to him by the aliens while he's sitting there on the examining table. And throughout the whole entire session, this gentleman was able to relay his information seamlessly. And for whatever reason, once it came to what was it that the aliens were saying directly to him, all of a sudden he started to stutter. Now, in reality, he didn't stutter. He didn't stutter prior to being asked about what he was being told by the aliens. And he didn't stutter after he was asked other information, and it had absolutely nothing to do with his alien abductors. The other thing that they had noticed was what they refer to as verbal blocks. In some occasions, the witnesses were asked for to articulate more information about whatever it might be, the interior of the craft or what was going on. And they said in certain cases, some people would for seconds, wouldn't say a word. They would have to sit there. I'm assuming on my part, they'd have to sit there and kind of think of, well, what's going on, and then try and come up with something. And he said this would last from several seconds to several minutes. Another one that I thought was really, really interesting is they did a comparison of drawings. So there was a team of UFO investigators that had done a case just a couple months prior to the experiment taking place. During their investigation, they had actually asked a quote unquote real abductee to do a drawing of what it was that they had seen and what the ship looked like and all the other things that had gone along with that. Now, this team of investigators was brought in and did an interview or asked questions during one of the hypnotic sessions of a imaginary abductee. In the end, the real and the not real abductees came up with, I won't call it identical, but man, they were so, so similar in the way that they drew things, the way that they spaced things. Maybe the wording was slightly different compared to what they would call the real abductees. But for the most part, man, I would say these things were probably about 85-90% similar. When Dr. Lawson was asked why were those things so similar to one another, one of his comments was, well, maybe it's possible that these people were influenced by ESP in some way, shape, or form. I'm going to come up with what I think is, and again, I'm not a doctor, not an expert by any stretch of the imagination, but what I think is a much more logical explanation of what happened here. So I always come back to common denominators. What is the common denominator in this case? I'm going to say the investigators. So you have these UFO investigators. They have experience with this previous case. I didn't hear the interview. I haven't listened to tapes or anything like that. So I have no idea what questions they asked. I don't know how they asked these questions. Is it possible that during this process, they were able to relay some information in what they said or how they said to the imaginary abductee? And then they were able to kind of, the abductee was kind of able to take that information and sort of run with that. So my logical explanation would be there has to be some sort of connection because of the simple fact that you have the same people conducting both interviews and you have the same result or an almost same result from both interviews. The other thing that I thought was, it absolutely blew my mind, was the parallel between a person's medical history and physical examinations on the part of abductees. So one of the things that they noted, and I'll give you a couple of quick examples. So it's a very small sample size. And one of the things that Dr. Lawson had said was, admittedly, it's a small sample size. And he believed that it was possible that the abductees were drawing on prior medical emergencies or experiences that they had prior to their abductions. And it was kind of like one of those, we'll call it a fill in the blank, so to speak, situation where maybe they were asked, it took them a couple seconds to come up with a response to satisfy the person who was doing the investigation or asking the questions. And it like, boom, all of a sudden it clicked and they remembered having this experience. One of the examples that he gives is Sandy Larson. So if I remember correctly, Sandy Larson was a from North Dakota. And when she was abducted, she had mentioned something to the effect of having something placed over her face, that she had her sinuses scraped by her alien examiner. What they found out afterward was, prior to her abduction, she had actually had sinus surgery. Another example that he gives is there was a California woman, and unfortunately, they don't give a name in this particular case. She, and along with her sisters, had been abducted. And during the abduction process or the examination process, she had been catheterized. Now, come to find out afterward, same or similar situation with Sandy Larson. This woman had been in a hospital. She had a hospital stay prior to her abduction, sometime prior to the abduction. And during that hospital stay, she had actually been catheterized. There's another case, I'm trying to remember where it was that I saw it, but somebody else had an issue. They had to have their tonsils removed. And, when they were under, hypnosis, had said to the, something to the effect of having surgery done on their face and their throat and that kind of thing. Come to find out, this woman had a tonsillectomy when she was much, much younger. In conclusion, Dr. Lawson will go on to present his information to the first International UFO Congress in June of 1977. A month later, he presents that information to MUFON at a conference in 1977. He received cold receptions from both groups and would be heavily criticized by basically by the UFO world. The one thing he compared it to, it's kind of like if you have somebody who is overly religious, and he was like the atheist that was kind of being thrown into the equation. People didn't like it. The UFO people didn't like it, because here's a guy who's asking a question that nobody really wanted to ask. One of the things that always pops up in my head when I start looking at this stuff is, and I'm a history teacher, those who do not know their history are doomed to repeat it. I try not to use that in my class if I can help it. But I can't think of another case where it's more true. Think about it. Right, what's going on right now was repeated in the 90s, was repeated in the 80s, was repeated in the 70s and the 60s and so on. And it still continues to this day. We live in a world where critical thinking is at an all-time low. We have people who idolize these false prophets of the UFO world, and they make bold claims and they provide zero evidence to back these claims. And people just blindly follow this stuff. These guys tell us to weaponize our curiosity by subscribing to their podcasts, their YouTube channels, or by buying their books. And then when someone urges them to take a step back and think for a moment, think for ourselves, or question whistleblowers, where did they get this information? How come they can't support their claims? The false prophets, their credulous followers, they're like locusts. They just swarm and attack those people who are asking them to provide the evidence. Those people who are pursuing the truth are attacked for just asking simple questions. I think we need more people like Dr. Lawson, guys like a Phil Kloss, people who are out there pursuing the truth and pushing the envelope. I would throw in a couple other names too. John Greenwald Jr., You have guys like Jack Brewer, all these people when they do their work. And that's why I follow these guys, is because of the simple fact that any claims that they make, they always provide the evidence and where they got that evidence. And they're very upfront and transparent about what they did, how they got it, and how they came to their conclusions. And I think that's one of the things that people need to be more cognizant about, is going about making sure that you don't just blindly believe what people throw in front of you. If you do those things, if you are more critical, if you ask those questions, I think in the end, it will definitely leave you in a much, much better headspace. That's it for me, Joe. I'm going to kick it back to you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, John. I definitely believe that we do need skeptics in this world, and especially in the paranormal community. You know, you want to look at things when you're experiencing something and when you're investigating something, you want to look at the logical explanation first. You know, if you hear a noise in your attic, you want to check for leaks, you want to check for rodents and stuff like that before you go and say it's Uncle Bob up there, you know. But at the same token, if Uncle Bob is in front of your bed and he's hovering, you know, 5 feet over the ground, he passed away 20 years ago, and you're looking straight at him, you know, chances are that's the real thing, unless you're dreaming, you know. But that's we definitely need skeptics in this community. With that said, you know, thank you so much for your segment, John. I totally appreciate it. By the way, guys, if you have any paranormal experiences you would like to share, or if you're a paranormal investigator, author, you know, to do with the paranormal or anything like that, or any unexplained stuff, please get in touch with me, 845-600-0744, or you could email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You could do so anonymously if you'd like, and I would love to hear your experiences. So, as promised, on to the last segment here. We are going to talk about possibly the most haunted spot in Australia. It is called the Monte Cristo Homestead. In New South Wales, Australia, lies arguably the most haunted house in Australia. It was built by a farmer named Christopher Crawley for his family in the town of Junee. They lived in a very desolate and poor life until Mr. Crawley, if you know, you know, changed his status in 1878 when the Great Southern Railway line opened. He scraped together all of his money to build and open the Railway Hotel. It was pretty much one of the only businesses in town, and it thrived. And Mr. Crawley became quite wealthy. He was revered and loved by the townfolk for his generosity, but this isn't where the story ends. Mr. Crawley had died. I love saying that, by the way, because it really reminds me of Mr. Crawley, an Aussie song. Had died due to blood poisoning in 1910, and his wife Elizabeth had locked herself inside the house because she couldn't cope with the loss of her husband. She eventually passed away in 1933 at the age of 92. Unfortunately, from 1948 until it was purchased in 1963, the house was vandalized and everything was sold and stolen. It was purchased in 1963 by Reginald and Olive Ryan, and they had restored it back to its original state, including a doll museum. That's quite randomly a very creepy addition. But when they had first moved in, they had noticed that their animals didn't want to enter the house. They would find the lights on after turning them off and had heard strange noises. It's believed that the homestead is haunted by at least 10 ghosts. Apparently, the previous owners didn't like animals because, besides the other non-violent occurrences, the Ryans had found all of their chickens strangled to death. I guess they really choked a lot of chickens. Anyway, also their parrot was choked to death, and the parrot was still in the cage. A litter of kittens that they had raised were also found brutally killed. Well, that's terrible. Christopher Crawley's ghost is said to haunt the homestead along with his wife. And if she doesn't want you there, you'll feel icy cold air hitting your skin. Christopher Crawley had gotten two of his housemates pregnant, one of which committed suicide while pregnant, and sometimes a ghostly bloody stain still appears to show up where she had landed from time to time. The second maid ended up having the child. She named him Harold. Harold was unfortunately involved in a horrific accident, hit by a coach, which caused him brain damage. He was kept in chains in the house all the time. The kids would mock him. You know, the school kids would walk by and mock him because they would hear his screams coming from the outside. His ghostly screams and rattling chains can still be heard to this day. The coach house is haunted by a young stable boy also named Morris. He didn't feel well one day and decided to stay in bed at the coach house. His master didn't approve of that and had put the boy's straw mattress on fire, thinking he would jump up and get to work. You know, of course, why wouldn't, you know, hey, light a fire under his ass, right? But Morris was too ill, and he couldn't get up. So he ended up dying in his bed. People hear his screams up until today, actually. Another haunting is that of Crowley's infant granddaughter, Ethel, who died in 1917 from one of the housemaids dropping her down the stairs. Some guests to the homestead feel as though they are being pushed on their backs or claim to feel an icy cold tiny hand holding their hand when they walk upstairs. There are more hauntings as well, including disembodied whispers, unexplained mists, orbs flying around, as well as poltergeist activity. So if you're ever go to this part of Australia, or if you've ever been there, please give me a call. You know the number by now, but I'll say it again. It's 845-600-0744 or email me at ghostshowny@gmail.com. Well, that's going to do it for me, guys. I hope you enjoyed this bonus episode. On the next episode, more horrible reviews with Edge Grave Dave, haunted eBay, and paranormal news. Have an awesome new year, everybody. Later. Thank you for listening to the Warp Reality Podcast, and thank you to all my guests and contributors that help make this show possible. For more episodes, guest info, social media links, merch, and more, please check out warprealitypodcast.com. If you have a paranormal experience you would like to share, questions, comments, or you would like to be a guest in the show, please leave me a voicemail at 845-600-0744, or you can email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You can do so anonymously if you'd like. Also, I'd greatly appreciate it if you could leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or warprealitypodcast.com. Have a great night, everyone, and don't forget to change your thoughts.